My name is Bobby Rogers. I know most of the people in the room. I'm a professor of English here at Union University, a writer in residence. I'm I suppose I should come on and get a hand up. This hand up. I should come clean. I am a poet. I'm the creative writing person here. So you're very much getting a poet's perspective. I'm not a professional theologian, and as you'll see, I've done nothing in this paper to endanger my amateur status as a theologian. My presentation actually has a title now. It's much better than the one on the conference materials. It's called "Therefore Now Put Off Thy Ornaments: The Lingering Influence of the King James Bible in Contemporary American Poetry." I was very surprised when I started working on these ideas last year, how easy it was, actually, and how pervasive the King James Bible is in contemporary American poetry. There's a handout at the back, and the poets on that handout may be people you're not familiar with. If you were a working poet, you'd recognize them as some of our most important poets writing today. Mark Jarman teaches up at Vanderbilt the prize-winning poetry, and James Tate, one of the poets, and I'll talk about them a little later, and Adrian Rich, maybe the most important poet of her generation. So it's an honor to be asked to speak at this conference. I've made secret of my love of the King James Bible, so much so that in Sunday school I am never called on to read scripture because people know it's going to be here comes the King James Bible. I also claim the KJV as an influence in my own writing, my own poetry. In an interview I gave on the Tennessee Humanities Council website when my book, Paper Anniversary, was being published, I claimed to be the last Southern poet who came by the influence of the KJV honestly. That is to say, as a child, sitting in an uncomfortable oak pew Sunday after sultry Sunday while Southern ministers read scripture at me, and yes, and I was wearing a clip-on tie, so I love the KJV, and happy to be here to talk about this. To get through all my argument, I'll be summarizing some things and lightly touching on other things, and so there may be a little bit of a disjointed quality to my remarks, but don't feel cheated. The actual complete essay is sort of disjointed as well. I'm used to a very different structure in my discipline for conference papers. You generally get about 15 to 18 minutes, and you're expected to read verbatim from your paper. So with this longer period of time, and we have an informal group here, if you want to stop me and raise a hand at some point, I will probably be happy to address a question in medias res here before we get to the discussion time at the end. Let me begin with an anecdote from the classroom. Several years ago, I was teaching a poem by Adrian Rich, and that's how she pronounces it, by the way, Adrian, and I sometimes have difficulty remembering that. I called her Adrian Rich for so long. But her poem, Living in Sin, is anthologized widely. It's one of her early poems. It portrays a loveless relationship in very accessible 20th century language. Rich is not a religious poet, but the use of that term sin in the title alerts the reader to possible biblical resonances in the text. Even though the primary denotation of the phrase is the rather moralistic 1950s term for cohabitating outside of wedlock, but amidst the utterly contemporary words of the poem, Rich embeds this odd modifier, sepulchral. And sepulcher is a word that appears 76 times in the King James, 32 times in the Gospels. And I knew the adjectival form of that word might trip up my students just a little bit. So, but when I asked if anyone in the room knew what a sepulcher was, not a single hand went up, even from my most youth group Bible study acculturated students. I mean, most of them had a Bible on their desk. Many of them had it open during the class, but nobody could tell me what a sepulcher was. It occurred to me that none of these young persons in this room had ever had the King James Version read as a part of their liturgical experience. So I'm not here to think about, you know, what effect the loss of King James language might have on their worship lives, but I do want to consider, you know, what effect the KJV has on contemporary American poetry at this moment, and to what ends a politically radical poet like Audre Rich might, you know, avail herself of this 400-year-old translation. The King James, of course, played a central role in American literature, and here's part of the, I'm going through pages very quickly. Walt Whitman, which is where American poetry begins, was hugely influenced by the King James Version. He claimed to have no influences whatsoever, but his writing is shaped by political discourse of the day, by operatic recitative, but probably more so than anything else, by the cadences of the King James Bible. And I use Whitman to lead into a discussion of my modern poets. And they're all, you know, as I said, this is not a selection of particularly obscure poets. These are all mainstream poets. Jarman teaches at Vanderbilt. They've all won the major prizes. Tate won the Pulitzer. Audre Rich, you just can't ignore her. And yet, they all avail themselves of this translation. Mark Jarman has often foregrounded religious concerns in his work. One thing that might be interesting to know about Mark Jarman is he is a PK. His father was an evangelical minister. So it's perhaps not surprising that we get biblical resonances in his poem. At this, we've got If I Were Paul on our handout here. Despite its titular claim of deriving from the Pauline epistles, the tone and stylistic influence here are more largely those of the Hebrew scriptures. See, but we'll hear this thing loud in just a moment. As in the Psalms, parallelism is pronounced, and I don't analyze it as much as I do in a few minutes in the Rich poem. And it's the major organizing strategy in this prose poem. There's a strain of natural generic imagery in the poem that is suggestive of the narrow orthodoxy of imagery found in Psalms. The images we are provided in the Psalms come from really a very narrow menu of images, and Jarman has natural images suggest that. But the poem's major effects come from the jarring contrasts of the first century trappings of the epistle and many of the modern elements of the poem. The sudden appearance of penicillin, or speed of light, skin cancers, cauterize, all these things stand out. The contemporary existing alongside first century Palestine and Elizabethan England in one text. The ancient elements of KJV influence become a bright foil behind the modern illusions of the poem. The first thing to notice about Jarman's poem is that it's a prose poem. This is a radical form that retains its experimental quality over a century and a half after Baudelaire set the standards for its composition. As former U.S. poet laureate Charles Simic has noted, perhaps only half, Simic says everything, perhaps only half jokingly, the prose poem is the result of two contradictory impulses, prose and poetry, and therefore cannot exist, but it does. The form is still unsettling for many readers, and I've long suspected that prose poetry is influenced by the KJV's refusal to reproduce line breaks, of the original Hebrew poetry, thus rendering Hebrew scriptures as de facto prose poems, prose poetry itself, for the most part. KJV, which follows the precedent of the Hebrew manuscripts and runs everything together in dense, unpunctuated columns, may be the earliest model for this contemporary and controversial form. Many contemporary poets, prose poets, seem to be seeking what Robert Alter identifies as the graphic leveling of poetry with prose, which we encounter in biblical poetry. The prose poem is still a very radical type of poetry. In some quarters, it's still not considered a fully legitimate poetic form. One has only to remember in the 90s, in 1990 actually, when Charles Simic's book, The World Does Not End, Prose Poems, was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. There was a large outcry from supposed more traditionalists, people who were offended that there was no lineation in these poems. How's this poem given the most significant literary prize in the United States? But I think the prose poem is especially ripe for influence by biblical text. The KJV, with its unlineated Hebrew poetry, superficially prose-like yet dense with musical and dramatic effects, not determined by measurable meter and rhyme, provides the first model for this radical subgenre, establishing many precedents for the effects possible in this form. If I Were Paul lacks the continuous quality we associate with prose, however, it begins with five consider statements, a sort of pentalogue of thou shalt. And why don't we hear these first five units of this poem aloud, If I Were Paul. Consider how you were made. Consider the loving geometry that sketched your bones, the passionate symmetry that sewed flesh to your skeleton, and the cloudy zenith which your soul descended in shimmering rivulets across pure granite to pour as a single braided stream into the skull's cup. Consider the first time you conceived of justice, engendered mercy, brought parity into being, coaxed liberty like a marten from its den to uncoil its limber spine in a sunny clearing. How you understood the inheritance of first principles, the legacy of noble thought, and built a city like a forest in the forest, and erected temples like thunderheads. Consider, as if it were penicillin or the speed of light, the discovery of another's hands, his oval field of vision, her muscular back and hips, his nerve-jarred neck and shoulders, her bleeding gums and dry elbows and knees, his baldness and cauterized skin cancers, her lucid and forgiving gaze, his healing touch, her mind like a prairie. Consider the first knowledge of otherness, how it felt. Consider what you were meant to be in the egg, in your parents' arms, under a sky full of stars. And I'm going to break up my reading of this poem for reasons you'll see it in a moment. The poem takes much from Genesis, centered in creation. And for Jarman, creation is a formal accomplishment. Jarman is a leading voice in the neo-formalist movement. Form is crucial for him. Creation is described, you know, form is describable in terms of geometry and symmetry, and also one of intent in this poem. Intent is difficult to talk about, difficult to image, but design is measurable, apparent, everlasting. It shouldn't be surprising that Jarman, as the poet here most aligned with evangelical sensibilities, is the one who avails himself of a translation other than the King James. The vivid single-syllable verbs in the consider statements, skew, so, poor, are variations on a theme from Psalm 139, actually. But the image offered when the speaker proclaims that the Creator God knit me together in my mother's womb doesn't appear in the King James. This is one of those rare moments. I think this may be the exception to prove the rule. In a later translation that I find to be stylistically preferable to the KJV. The consider statements of it in King James rhythm provides variations on the psalmic theme of being knit in the womb. Variations on the theme is itself a form, that this poem is a form within a form within a form. I mean, we may think prose poetry is rather formless. I would argue it has formal expectations. Jarman is putting in a sort of variations on a theme form, which Stanley Sadie's Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians defines it as variations on form. Its repetitions generate a continuously unfolding structure with new figurations and textures at each statement of theme. Variations which are inherently paratactic, based on an iteration of items in a linear series. The weaving theme is developed with images of interwoven lines, crosshatched, that make up the loving geometry that sketched your bones. This is a weaving motif. The shimmering rivulets interflow in what must be a similar weaving over the granules of water-polished stone. And most explicitly in this first section of the poem, the motif is reprised in the braided stream of the soul poured into the skull's cup. This is a decidedly concrete complex of images that John is putting together for us here. Wayne Meeks says of the Apostle Paul, many of his concerns are specifically anti-mystical. And though I'm not sure the concerns of Jarman's Paul are exactly the same as those of the historical Paul, he does practice an earthbound rhetoric, positing an argument from the physical that he isn't sure will succeed in transferring its meaning to another human. It's essentially an argument from design, but unlike Frost's handling of the concept but Mark Jarman loves Armand Frost. Jarman pushes even further to consider how to act and what may be expected in light of the certain failure of this argument. No matter how powerfully framed, how to act morally and meaningful from premises that are faulty or incomplete. And let's look at the second section of the poem, where we leave the consider statements and move to something slightly different. Now imagine what I have to say when I learn of your enterprising viciousness, the discipline with which one of you turns another into a robot, or a parasite, or a maniac, or a body strapped to a chair. Imagine what I have to say. Do the impossible. Restore life to those you have killed. Wholeness to those you have maimed, goodness to what you have poisoned, trust to those you have betrayed. Bless each other with the heart and soul, the hand and eye, the head and foot, the lips, tongue and teeth, the inner ear and the outer ear, the flesh and spirit, the brain and bowels, the blood and lymph, the heel and toe, the muscle and bone, the waist and hips, the chest and shoulders, the whole body clothed and naked, young and old, aging and growing up. I send you this not knowing if you will receive it, or having received it, you will read it, or having read it, you will know that it contains my blessing. the final four paragraphs here, are the proportional approximation of a sestet, the unbalanced shorter second unit of a sonnet. And they perform the function of a sestet. They follow what is recognizable as a turn, a rather dramatic turn, I might argue. Now imagine what I have to say. Signaling a transition from a reflective mode to a more active stance marked by a new class of active commands, do the impossible. Restore life, restore wholeness, restore goodness. Bless each other. German's Paul Aspirant speaks emphatically with some of the tactlessness and impatience that the historical Paul, at least in my reading of tone, displayed toward the Galatians, as this sestetish unit at the end of this this poem. Also beginning right here. And I'll leave those three highlighted. Comments on and responds to the conditions asserted in the first five prose paragraphs of the poem, which we now are, I think, encouraged to think of as an octave. So we glance down at the page and we see something which is apparently formless, a prose poem without lineation. And you know, not only, well, prose poems have certain forms, and not only is it a variations on theme structure from music, but there's a sonnet buried in here as well. And we might even argue that the final stanza, the final paragraphs, I send you this, not knowing, has the concluding force of a couplet. So, like the King James itself, we have the combining of, you know, the ancient and the Elizabethan. So much of those Elizabethan sensibilities to mark that interpretation. And for me, we also have this compelling modern element, the prose poem, and that the actions prescribed here to be carried out were consciously based on incomplete yet deeply felt premises, which really is the model of faith. So, questions or remarks about that disturbing prose poem for Forge?
Well, something I've wondered about Jarman, because I taught him for the first time last spring, and I wasn't able to find much on this. What are his religious views? You say he was raised in the church.
Yes.
And I, from looking at some of his poetry, he seems to be critical of the church, but is he a believer?
I know where he worships in Nashville. He's rather an Eliot-like in his preference for Episcopal High Church services. I don't know how that has an impact on these, you know, a lot of people go to church and don't necessarily write religious poetry. That,
well, my students always want to know these questions. They want to know.
His followers rather intensely evangelical disciples of Christ, but more low church.
So he's moved. Just he's switched the kind of church he goes to, but he's stayed.
Yeah. He switched the style, but he kind of puts me in mind of Flannery O'Connor. You know, he goes to a high church, but seems to have some kind of low church evangelical attitudes. Yeah, so
I hope we're all critical of the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and love it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's our job. Exactly. Well, more essential to my argument. I think the word are the poems by poets who weren't raised in the church, perhaps, and have no explicit religious intent in their work. James Tate is the author of 15 books of poetry. His highly regarded first collection, The Lost Pilot, won the Yale Series of Younger Poets when he was just 24. But more importantly for us, I think it was one of the most influential books of the 1970s. Tate won the Pulitzer in 91 for his selected poems. Continues to teach in the MFA program at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. The poem I'm considering here, The Promotion, was published in his 2004 collection, Return to the City of White Donkeys. You see, in my specialty, I can sit around and read books with titles like Return to the City of White Donkeys and it's work. It's professional development. This poem is, among other things, a commentary on office life. Perhaps you'll relate to it. Here, it goes like this, Promotion. I was a dog in my former life, a very good dog, and thus I was promoted to human being. I liked being a dog. I worked for a poor farmer, guarding and herding his sheep. Wolves and coyotes tried to get past me almost every night, and not once did I lose a sheep. The farmer rewarded me with good food, food from his table. He may have been poor, but he ate well. And his children played with me when they weren't in school or working in the field. I had all the love any dog could hope for. When I got old, I got a new dog, and I trained him in the tricks of the trade. He quickly learned, and the farmer brought me into the house to live with the family. I brought the farmer his slippers in the morning, as he was getting old, too. I was dying slowly, a little bit at a time. The farmer knew this and would bring the new dog in to visit me from time to time. The new dog would entertain me with his flips and flops and nuzzles. And then one morning, I just didn't get up. They gave me a fine burial down by a stream under a shade tree. That was the end of my being a dog. Sometimes I miss it, so I sit by the window and cry. I live in a high-rise that looks out at a bunch of other high-rises. At my job, I work in a cubicle and barely speak to anyone all day. This is my reward for being a good dog. The human wolves don't even see me. They fear me. It's not the type of poem one expects to find haunted by the words and cadences and poetics of the Christian Bible. It's a surrealist poem. We get a lot of this in Tate. A poem of reincarnation. A poem that on its surface seems more clownish and jocular, having more in common with a brief vignette, a bit. They always call those bits in a stand-up comedian's routine. Than to be related in any way to the portentous seriousness we are comfortable projecting on the scripture and on the poetry, by the way. It is, after all, a comedy cliche, the talking dog joke, worthy of a classic Warner Brothers cartoon. But as in so much of Tate's work, the comedic is never far removed from profound pathos, and the poem has a greater depth in its comedic voice and bizarre situation suggests. The Promotion is more purely a prose poem with fewer structural vestiges intruding from the world of verse than Jarman's prose poem. Jarman's very uncomfortable about form. Tate doesn't bother him one little bit. Alter claims that prose is always influenced by the poetry of the same culture and that poetry should be influenced by prose. The Promotion is a single paragraph, a block of unadorned words with no traces of stanza or sonnet form to provide any subtler organization. The poem is an anecdote. It's two anecdotes, actually, flatly told. The word prose is derived from the Latin prosa, literally straightforward, but there is little that is straightforward about this poem. Sentence structure in the KJV is less sophisticated than in more recent translations, favoring loose coordination over more complex sentences that employ subordination to more firmly determine emphasis and meaning, a control of emphasis which provides sentences that tend to interpret themselves. The simplicity of KJV prose, as Harold Hammond points out in his contribution to Alfred Kermode's Literary Guide to the Bible, which has probably been quoted many times up and down the face always, leaves its narrative structure open to the widest possible range of meaning. Biblical narrative, according to Eric Auerbach, was not primarily oriented toward realism. It was oriented toward truth. In his introduction to the 1997 Best American Poetry Anthology, Tate has a word or two to say about truth, and I'm quoting from it here. When you come across a poem you especially like, what separates it from so many other well-made poems is its quality of insight. And for this word insight, I would happily substitute the loftier words revelation or epiphany. So it would seem we are not out of order to go in search of religious meaning in Tate's poetry. He goes on in the same introduction, that he doesn't write a great deal of prose. He goes on to say in this introduction, or non-poetic prose, I should say, while most prose is a kind of continuous chatter, describing, naming, explaining, poetry speaks against an essential backdrop of silence. It is almost reluctant to speak at all, knowing that it can never fully name what is at the heart of its intention. There's a prayerful, haunted silence between words, between phrases, between images, ideas, and lines. The telling of this narrative is a spare and as super economical as any telling in the Hebrew Scriptures. Tate is uninterested in painting a richly evocative scene. We do not, it's not a nature poem. We do not get this beautiful rendering of the bucolic life here. This approach puts me in mind of Auerbach's famous comparison of biblical narrative with Homer's more detailed, rich approach to narrative. And Auerbach characterizes biblical style this way: the externalization of only so much of the phenomenon as is necessary for the purpose of the narrative, all else left in obscurity. A hyper economy. The decisive points of the narrative alone are emphasized. What lies between is non-existent. Time and place are undefined and call for interpretation. Thoughts and feeling remain unexpressed, are only suggested by the silence and the fragmentary speeches. And finally, the whole permeated with the most unrelieved suspense and directed toward a single goal. And to that extent, far more oriented, remains mysterious. The style of Tate's poem fits without much difficulty into this list of traits. The narrative of the promotion quickly moves from the dog's prime to the dog's dotage, through the dog's death and burial to the dog's reincarnation as a human being living in a high-rise and toiling anonymously in an office cubicle, the human equivalent of a doghouse. Time and place are undefined. Only the briefest curriculum vitae of the dog's life is possible. But the biblical spareness here accords much more dignity to the dog's life. The poem's single goal, it seems to me, certainly its leading goal, is an investigation of dignity, and explored through the theme of the dog's house. I'm sure there's some embedded pun in here about being in the doghouse. The dog moves from dignified outside labor to retirement in his master's house, to the city, where there are many high-rises, many mansions. Maybe I'm making too much of a claim to that KJV idea of heaven. And then finally to the cubicle, the human labor, and just the human equivalent of a doghouse. It's the King James translation that is in largest measure responsible for the paraphrasis we associate with biblical style, and particularly the piling up of simple statements, one after the other, in poetry. Hebrew poetry is actually not perfectly paratactic. It does use the conjunction weh or we. Hebrew is one of the many languages I don't have. It's a trait of the English translations to imitate the austerity of the Hebrew poetry by omitting many of the conjunctions. Most other European translations reproduce the simple connective throughout.
Did you say this poem is written this century, 2005, was it?
Yes.
So there's huge echoes of postmodernism disconnect, isn't
there? Oh, certainly. We might see some more in the rich poem as well, but maybe even in the Tate, in the Jarman poem. Jarman is much more conservative in his theology, but there seems to me this sort of fatalism in if this communication is actually going to achieve what he hopes it's going to achieve. Barbara Herzstein Smith makes the claim that paratactic structure diminishes the importance of sequence and that units may be rearranged at will. This may be true of certain nursery rhymes and other naive texts, but it is less generally true of Hebrew poetry. Her ancillary claim is only one, I think, though, that paratactic structure, this simplistic one simple thing after another structure, may be used in a highly civilized and urbane poem, as we have just seen. She was looking at another poem, Surrey, actually. The quality of naivete suggested by this structure has in fact been exploited by poets when certain effects are wanted, such as forthrightness, honesty, or simplicity. And I think it's one of the things Tate's trying to get out of the structure here. The power of the ending comes from the this injunction, you know, they fear me not. We fear not becomes this motif we encounter from the angels and multiple times from Jesus in the King James, in the Gospels. Fear seems to characterize the people Jesus can reach. Fear and brokenness, to be poor in spirit. The intrusion of the direct object me in this final line does little to undo the dignity and formality of the reversed fear and not, you know, that we associate with King James. The humans in Tate's parable have lost the ability to fear. Cubicle life has drained them of fear, drained them of life. Only those capable of fear and need of comfort from fear can access the kingdom of heaven. This heaven, the dog has been promoted to, with its many skyscrapers, its many mansions, with its high rise that looks out on a bunch of other high rises. Echoing the many mansions of the King James imaging of heaven, is more like a hell, it seems to me. The dog has lost all agency, has no contribution to make, is isolated and ignored, he is made invisible. The dog has been made human. The humans are wolves, in this whole parable. The dog would have been better off to stay a dog. So I've got questions on that. Probably poem. The final poem I'm going to look at is a poem by Adrian Rich. It's a part of a longish poetic sequence. And I'm really more interested in the deeper structures and strategies bequeathed by the KJV than I am in the occasional obscure Elizabethan word like sepulcher or the occasional stylistic flourish like fear not. Adrian Rich's poem
Dedications is an example of how the structures of Hebrew poetics remain vital for poets working in even the most contemporary modes. This poem concludes her poetic sequence, An Atlas of the Difficult World, the title poem of her 13th book, published in 1991. Rich is writing at the height of her power. Rich was, really her project was to dismantle traditions. She is not a traditional poet at all, to dismantle the meta-narrative of patriarchy. So it's rather surprising that we found this. There's a handout right there. Don't miss the handout. Handout's the best thing about this. I'll read this poem for us, and then maybe we can finish up saying a few things about it. Dedications. I know you're reading this poem late, before leaving your office. The one intense yellow lamp spot in the darkening window, and the lassitude of a building faded to quiet long after rush hour. I know you're reading this poem standing up in a bookstore far from the ocean on a gray day of early spring, faint flakes driven across the plains, enormous spaces around you. I know you're reading this poem in a room where too much has happened for you to bear, where the bedclothes lie in stagnant coils on the bed, and the open valise speaks of flight, but you cannot leave yet. I know you're reading this poem as the underground train loses momentum, and before running up the stairs toward a new kind of love your life has never allowed. I know you're reading this poem by the light of the television screen, where soundless images jerk and slide while you wait for the newscast from the Intifada. I know you're reading this poem in a waiting room of eyes met and unmeeting, of identity with strangers. I know you're reading this poem by fluorescent light and the boredom and fatigue of the young who are counted out, count themselves out too early in age. I know you're reading this poem through your failing sight, the thick lens enlarging these letters beyond all meaning, yet you read on because even the alphabet is precious. I know you're reading this poem as you pace beside the stove warming milk, a crying child on your shoulder, a book in your hand, because life is short and you too are thirsty. I know you're reading this poem which is not in your language, guessing at some words while others keep you reading, and I want to know which words they are. I know you're reading this poem, listening for something, torn between bitterness and hope, turning back once again to the task you cannot refuse. I know you're reading this poem because there's nothing else left to read there where you've landed, stripped as you are. The poem is made up of 12 incantatory psalmic iterations of the same extended parallel structure. Robert Alter emphasizes that parallelism does not mean simply saying the same thing again in different words, but that each re-saying should in a rigorous way further the intent of the poem. Each restatement is a poetic challenge. I would argue that good poetry at all times is intellectually robust activity to which such laziness is alien. Structuralist Roman Jakobson, it's just not a legitimate paper like this one if you don't throw in structuralist Roman Jakobson, observed that pervasive parallelism inevitably activates all levels of language. The distinctive features, inherent and prosodic, the morphological and syntactic categories and forms, the lexical units and their semantic classes, and both their convergences and divergences, acquire an autonomous poetic value. Rich's parallel structure begins with the seven-word clause. And I've made them red. It's not a... doesn't show up particularly well in this, but I know you're reading this poem. There are 12 of these parallel unit markers introducing the parallel structure. I believe Martin Luther King says, "I have a dream," 16 times in his famous speech. There are 12 of these parallel introductions, repeated verbatim, seven words. They comprise 23.27%. See how Jakobson inspired me? 23.27% of the verbiage of the poem. Each of these iterations is followed by a scene, a dramatic scene of a reader encountering the poem. A description of the physical setting in which the reading takes place in the first nine iterations. And in the last three instances, a description of the poem itself, its conditions and attendant difficulties. One would be hard-pressed to produce a contemporary poem with a higher level of parallelism, at least one that wasn't marred by a descent into parody or strained formalism. Rich manages this extreme parallelism so skillfully that a kind of scriptural grandeur is conferred on these very humble folks here that she's describing. She also employs hyperspacing after each full stop. Did you notice that? This is not like right there. That's more than the double space you're supposed to have, and we get it again there as well.
Okay.
Yes.
Is there a sense in which this generation, we, because of a loss of foundations, common foundations, that parallelism has to take us to get our attention constantly trying to draw us back further, deeper, because there was a commonality and that has gone. There are no assumptions anymore that we have that. Therefore, how do you, you have to push to try to find some kind of connection.
Yeah. Well, this is the, in the other 12 units of this sequence, there's nothing quite like this. We might think of this sequence as, 13 lines of a single poem, and this final line has a much more rigorous formal quality. And I don't know if she's seeking that, because really, Rich's career has been about dismantling form. And she began by winning the Yale series when, I think she was still at Radcliffe. She's like 21. What was it, Auden, who wrote this rather patronizing, left-handed introduction to that, talking about it. And here were all these poems. She'd written that first book, which Auden would embrace and love, because they were formal in a way that he practiced and championed. And Rich, very famously started realizing she had no precedents which were female, really, other than Emily Dickinson, perhaps. But she certainly wasn't writing like Dickinson. So she tore down all those, stopped writing in 1950s era academically accepted form, started writing this very radical free verse. And here she is, kind of in her early, late phase, finding a different form to replace that with this very traditional form, I think. I'm trying to connect it to the Bible and the ancient parallelism that we find in Psalms. So the verses, and of course we're probably familiar with, I'm getting short on time, We're probably familiar with the classification that Robert Loth applied to the Psalms. I mean, for centuries, everybody knew the Psalms were poetry, right? But we had no way to talk about their poetics. There was no discernible meter, so certainly no rhyme. I mean, rhyme is a very rare occurrence in the world's poetry. And Robert Loth came along in, 1750-something through the 60s and 70s, and established this sense that the Psalms are structured by juxtaposing parallel units in different ways, so that we have synonymous parallelism. And I probably should put in one of my slides from my world literature section when I teach the Psalms, and there are some of these things that are very visual that help us. I did give you a chart of the parallelism that I note in the poem, beginning with that there are six pairs of parallel units that I see. In 1A and B up there, I know you're reading this poem late before leaving your office in the one intense yellow lamp. So we have someone in, I don't know, maybe it's the office tower next to where the promoted dog is working in the Tate poem. Being forced into that cubicle life. The next one is someone standing up in a bookstore far from the ocean during business hours. So 1A, we have someone who's participating in the economy, who's working long hours. In 1B, we have somebody who seems to not be participating in the economy. This person is doing what people do to my book. They pull it off the shelf and they read it, and then they put it back on the shelf. And the next time they come in, then I read some more. I mean, just walk it up to the checkout. We might say that's an antithetical parallelism. And I chart some more here. The second one is very clearly antithetical. We have two romantic relationships, perhaps. In the first one, the person cannot leave. The bags are packed. The coils of bedclothes are stagnant. It's a stagnant, dead relationship. In 2B, the person is bounding out of the subway, a very different place in the relationship. Then in 3A and B, there's more of a synonymous grouping. To be a more in common. Then in 4, it's antithetical, synonymous. And so not only do we have this structure of two units side by side, we have these three unit structures of opposition, sameness, similarity, which gives structure to the poem. And that's very much the way Psalms are organized. So one of the things in these poems selected, not only do they have some superficial elements of King James, some word choice, some allusions, they also are on the surface very unformed poems that actually do have quite a rigorous structure below them. Maybe I'll stop there. Let me stop with my ending Bible text here, so my title will make sense. All the reader's rich imaginations have been humbled by forces beyond their control. They've been made vulnerable, broken, poor in spirit. They have landed, as the final line of the poem has it, brought to ground by personal, political, and economic realities, and are finally stripped, which is a term that contains all the modern connotations of being denuded and exposed, but also carries ancient connotations of humiliation and defeat, stripped of armor on the field of Troy. But a better image of grief might be found in the book of Exodus, and I am reading from the King James Version of God's Holy Word. For the Lord had said unto Moses, say unto the children of Israel, ye are a stiff-necked people. I will come up into the midst of thee in a moment and consume thee. Therefore now put off thine ornaments from thee, that I may know what to do unto thee. And the children of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments by the mount Horeb. Thanks.